From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
This week on the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, the November election raises two important questions. Who will be voting and how will they be voting?
An informed and engaged electorate is the cornerstone of any representative democracy. Yet increasingly, our democracy is threatened by general voter apathy. How do we get people to re-engage in the political process? We'll ask Alex Padilla, the California Secretary of State, and Mindy Romero, head of the California Civic Engagement Project at the UC Davis Center for Regional Change. Democracy at risk. Voter registration and turnout really do matter.
We'll also talk about how they'll be voting with John Myers from the Los Angeles Times and Dan Walters from the Sacramento Bee.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, and by Kaiser Permanente. Thrive from the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute. It's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. The California Civic Engagement Project is a nonpartisan civic engagement research and outreach initiative with UC Davis. The key focus is identifying disparities and opportunities in civic participation. Its founder and director, Mindy Romero, is our guest today. Welcome.
Thank you.
So let's get an overview on the percentages of voting age eligible Californians that are actually registered to vote.
Well, first off, registration rates are pretty low, actually, in California, I think, compared to what most people would expect. And there are pretty big disparities across groups, so not everybody registers at the same rates. So we'll say that at the outset. So right now, currently, registration rates are actually a little bit lower than we typically see. They're about 71% or so for the entire population. And then when we look at subgroups, Latinos are just under 60%, young people are around 50%, those age 18 to 24, Asian Americans around 50%. So we see big gaps in just people's ability to vote based on registration.
Because it's a presidential election year and everything that's going on, are you seeing more registrations increase?
Yeah, so the story's a little complicated. So actual rates are a little bit lower for most groups than we saw 4 years ago at the same time. But we've seen this big surge in registration. And I think what's happening is certainly people are motivated, people are thinking about the election. They started registering early in this cycle than we normally see. They registered in January, February, March, when normally we see a surge in maybe April, May. Mm-hmm. But it's just simply that registration rules have been cleaned up a little bit since 4 years ago. And of course, we've also had population increases since 4 years ago. So we are seeing more registered voters, but rates, so it's just more of a complicated story when we look at rates.
Let's talk about, after you register, you have to vote. So what is the percentage of voting age Californians that are actually voting?
The percentage of voting age. So let's talk about eligible. So those are adult citizens, right? Those that are by age and by citizenship. In 2014, which was a record low turnout, we saw only 31% of eligible voters that were actually voted.
Wow.
And in that record low turnout year, we should note that it was much lower for historically underrepresented groups. So Latinos, their turnout rate was only 17%. Asian Americans as a group, 18%. Those 18 to 24, only 8%. Was there eligible?
8%.
8.2% of eligible 18 to 24-year-olds in California actually voted.
Wow.
That was 285,000 out of the 3.5 million.
So you're kind of touching on this already, but what are the big demographic differences between voters and non-voters?
So that's a really great question. They're big. Overall, when you look at the pie of voters, those are actually voting in any given election, whether it's high turnout or low turnout, it doesn't look like the rest of the population as a whole, even the eligible voter population. And it looks very different from the population of non-voters. So the voting population, let me look at the non-voter population. It's probably a little more easier to dissect. And that's really who we want to target. So of those that are non-voters, about 7 million are eligible in California, but not registered. And about 60 to 70% are Asian and Latino combined. Young people are overrepresented amongst non-voters. Low-income folks, folks from low educational backgrounds are also overrepresented.
So basically what you're saying is it's the older, frankly, white homeowners are the kind of people that are voting, and it's the renters and under 45 are not voting.
Flip side is our voting electorate is older, whiter, wealthier, more educated, yes, also more likely to have a home, much more likely than the rest of.
So why are minority and youth rates and low-income worker rates so low, participation rates so low?
There's lots of reasons. First off, there are elements of our registration system, how our electoral system is designed, that we know from much research and from just voter data year after year, election after election, that shows that there are barriers to participating. And then there's the whole motivation question and the outreach question. So we know, for instance, registration, by those lower registration rates I just mentioned a moment ago, registration is less accessible for folks that are lower income, for folks of color. And they also get less outreach, less mobilization from campaigns that see them as not likely voters. And so
it feeds on itself.
It becomes a vicious cycle. And then there's also this whole question about feeling disconnected from the political process.
Right.
So you're talking, first off, about historically underrepresented groups that don't have the history or the connection. And then on top of that, our political environment, I think everybody, by and large, is having an issue with wondering how their vote matters.
Right. And there's a cynicism about the political process, probably.
And underrepresented groups wonder that even more.
You know, let me ask this last question. You know, some folks say, fine, why should we care? If these people don't care enough to vote, why should we care if they vote or not?
We should definitely care. The strength of our democracy, I'll give you the democracy answer,
okay.
Then I'll give you the practical, even more practical reason. Right now, by just looking at voter turnout rates, the state of our democracy is weak. Period. It's weak in the U.S. compared to the voter turnout rates of other established democracies. We are by far one of the lowest in the world. California has one of the lowest turnout rates in the nation. And then you look at some of these underrepresented groups, even lower. So we're the low of the low in that sense. But why should people vote? It's not just about the individual voice, which is important, that you feel like you had a say, right?
No.
But for policymakers, for decision makers, they need to hear from everyone, not just some people. They're making very important decisions that affect the entire state. And right now, as it stands, with low turnout rates and low participation and those uneven rates by group, they're only hearing from some Californians. How are they possibly able to make good, informed decisions that help everyone?
I'm going to leave that as a rhetorical question. I want to thank Amini Romero with UC Davis for explaining the voter registration and turnout rates. But before they can vote, they have to be registered. How do we increase voter registration? A conversation with California's Secretary of State Alex Padilla next. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome. The state's age-eligible voters seem to be disinterested and disengaged almost at epic proportions. So if we're going to change course, the first thing we have to do is get more people to register to vote. And that's been the focus of our next guest, the California Secretary of State, Alex Padilla. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So recently, though, there's been a dramatic uptick in registrations. What are the numbers and why is it happening?
Well, I think there's both good news to share, both short-term as well as long-term. Short-term, you know, it's clear to pretty much everybody that this is an election year. And among the things we'll be voting on is a new president of the United States. So that has a lot more people paying attention, excited about the upcoming election, energized. And we're seeing it in our voter registration numbers, including but not limited to the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that have gone to registertovote.ca.gov to register to vote or to update their registration.
We were talking earlier about those numbers. Those numbers are pretty dramatic. Over a million hits?
Yeah, nearly 1.8 million people since the first of the year through the deadline to register May 23rd for the June election, either to register for the first time or to update their registration.
Yeah, I've been reading that they're calling it historic, the growth in registration, so that's a good thing. Things are changing. Now, one of the things that happened back in January was the passage of this Motor Voter Act. It's supposed to increase voter registration by making it easier to register. How does the process work, and when is it going to be fully implemented?
Right. So last year, the legislature passed, and the governor signed the California New Motor Voter. So this is good news in forward years, not for 2016. But what we're going to be able to do once this is implemented is systematically register voters that are eligible when they're applying for or renewing a driver's license or state ID through the DMV.
A twofer.
It's a twofer. It's government efficiency.
Government efficiency, right.
At its finest. But, you know, think about how many millions of Californians go through the DMV each and every year that are sharing their name, their address, their date of birth, their signature, all the same information required when you register to vote. So if we know you're eligible, we can register you vote in the process, which is, I think, going to be good for democracy.
Is it automatic voter registration?
It's, you know, automatic voter registration. You know, we do have freedom of speech in this country. You have the right to not be a voter if you so choose. So we do give people the opportunity to opt out. But the default is, if we know you're eligible, you'll be added to the voter roll.
So how does it? Oregon also has something similar. How's California's different than Oregon's?
Yeah, that's a good question. Oregon was the first state in the nation to adopt an automatic registration law, and the way they're implementing it is, you know, they do an analysis on all the transactions, right? All the interfaces with DMV, and for people who they know are eligible, they send them a letter and they say, unless we hear from you otherwise, we're going to add you to the voter rolls. And by the way, can you tell us, you know, who your political party preference is and that sort of thing. We're going to be able to do that all at the transaction itself, at the counter, if you will, when you're at the DMV, or if you're renewing your driver's license by mail using those same forms. It's going to be more seamless. It's going to be a little bit less expensive for us to implement it, hopefully more effective.
Yeah, it seems more efficient. You're doing it right when they're there and not waiting till after they leave. So there's also, this law was passed in 2013 about people in the country legally allowing them to obtain a California driver's license. So how do you ensure that they aren't mistakenly registered when they're at DMV?
Good. Well, it's important to remember that we've been required by federal law for decades now to offer a voter registration opportunity at the DMV. It's a federal law known as Motor Voter. And so when we passed what's known as AB 60, affording undocumented individuals an opportunity to have a driver's license, we built into the procedures there a firewall, if you will. If they can't prove citizenship, they're not even afforded an opportunity to register to vote. And so we just got to keep those same protocols, those same firewalls, if you will, in place through the electronic version, which is what we call New Motor Voter.
Yeah, and I think that law that you're referring to is back in 1993, so the federal law. So that's,
right.
That's been around for quite some time, but taken a while to actually, something happened here in California, apparently. You know, they say that voting is a learned activity. There's some people actually talking about maybe we should lower the voting age to 16. I'm just curious about your thoughts on that. Either just that it's a learned activity and we need to get young people more engaged earlier, or lowering the voting age.
So I do think it is a learned activity. Most people will register, you know, when their parents have shown them the way, or, you know, for high school students, if their friends are excited and engaged, they'll kind of influence each other. We don't have right now in California, the legal age to register to vote is 18 years or older.
Right.
There's been a conversation about should we lower that threshold, and I think we've taken a half step there by allowing pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds.
What does that mean, pre-registration?
So pretty soon, if you're 16 years old, you'll be able to fill out that voter registration form, turn it in, and the county will sort of process that and hold that registration until the time of your 18th birthday.
So you're on the rolls.
And then you're automatically on the rolls. You don't have to worry about it when you're 18. You can get
happy
excited.
Birthday. You get to vote. You get to be on jury duty.
or even better than jury duty, what we do allow here in California is for 16 and 17-year-olds to work as student poll workers.
Oh.
Most counties need the help. You know, young people tend to have a lot of energy and are more likely to be bilingual. So when it comes to assisting voters with languages other than English, and they can get paid.
Great experience. Thank you for talking about how we increase voter registrations. Up next, getting voters to register is one part of the equation. The other half of the equation is getting them to vote. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with California Secretary of State Alex Padilla. First, understand that California has its own voter bill of rights. What should Californians know about their voting rights?
Well, I think it's a point of pride for California elections officials that while there's a federal Voting Rights Act that we just celebrated 50th anniversary of it last year, you know, it's a subject of debate and fight in other parts of the country where they're changing the rules on registration, changing the rules on how you can cast a ballot. I think in California, we pride ourselves in going above and beyond what those minimal protections are for the right to vote. It's the
it
most
seems,
fundamental
it's
right
interesting. In the rest
have.
Of the country, they're making it more difficult to vote, and in California, making it easier to vote, it seems to be.
Exactly, and I'm proud of that, because if you're eligible to vote, if you're 18 years or older and a citizen, there should be nothing unnecessary in your way between you and being able to register. That's why we can do it on paper, we can do it online in California, and being able to vote.
Yeah, so it's if we get people registered to vote, now we got to get them to vote. What are some of the cognitive barriers to voting?
No, I think as far as what's in place today, and we can talk about proposals on how to make it better in the future, we ensure things like if you have a language preference other than English, you have the ability to get your voting and elections information in your language of preference. You can sign up or make that modification on your voter registration record and get the materials in that way. You know, things like just making sure you know where your polling place is, easy ways to look that up, what the hours are, options. You can vote by mail, you can vote in person, all those fundamental rights that you should be aware of as a voter so that nobody can impede you.
Right. So what should voters be thinking about if they want to have a smooth election day experience?
You know, it's always good to have a plan, right? That's good life advice.
Right.
And so it is with elections. And so people knowing what their options are in advance, you know, if you want to vote by mail, know that you have that option, know what the process is of requesting a vote by mail ballot, what the deadlines are for getting that ballot in to make sure that it's counted. But if you're going to plan on going on election day, make sure you know what time on election day you're going to go. 7 a.m. the polls open, 8 p.m. the polls close. Far too often we hear people get caught up in traffic you know,
cutting it too close and
left work too late, that sort of thing. But also know that if you're in line at 8 o'clock, even though you haven't cast your ballot, you have the right to wait as long as it takes for you to get that ballot, cast it on your time frame. You're allowed the right to vote.
So we can avoid all of that by mail-in voting, right? We can avoid all those problems.
And more than 60% of Californians do.
Yeah, but I was wondering, you know, Oregon has an all mail-in voting system. Should we adopt that?
And so here we are as far as like what our ideas and proposals are for making voting easier in the future. Oregon, Washington has all vote-by-mail only elections. And I think their turnout is up since they've adopted that reform. I think California is a much bigger, more diverse state, and we have people who have just different preferences. And so I propose to the legislature that we allow counties to migrate to an election system where every voter gets their ballot in the mail automatically 4 weeks before Election Day, and we give people options on how to get that ballot back in through the mail, through ballot drop boxes that people can drop off anywhere in the county that's convenient to them, ballot drop-off stations, or even modernized polling places as we know them to what's referred to as vote centers.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, vote centers and kiosks. Should we get rid of these polling places? Sometimes you got, where's my polling place? And if you just had a center where you knew that's where they're collecting the ballots.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we're going to have multiple locations in each city, in each county, for people to come in and vote if they want to vote in person. But what we can do is modernize these polling places where we get away from the paper ledger that we're all used to when we vote in person and use technology, use laptops, have tablets, to have electronic access to the voter list, because what that will do is have each location, give each location access to the entire list of voters in the county, not just that neighborhood. So you give the voter the option of voting anywhere in the county that's convenient to them.
That's really important. You don't have to find your polling place. You can go to one of these voting centers and you're on the list.
And it gets better. And have these vote centers open for a week or 2 weeks leading up to the election. So you have options on when, where, and how to
cast
the ballot.
That would be very different. Let me ask you about online voting. Are we ever going to see that?
Maybe, but no time soon. You know, we have online voter registration, but we don't have online voting for two reasons. Most people will guess the first concern, right? It's security, right? Some form of, is it hackable? Right. You know, what's election integrity? But also from a point of view of privacy, we have a secret ballot in California and in this country. We know who votes. We know who votes by mail versus in person, but we don't know who voted for who. We can't tell the contents of somebody's ballot. And until the internet is built to protect that, we won't see online voting.
What about using technology and social media to kind of encourage, motivate, particularly younger voters?
Right. Absolutely. And I think that's been the reason for a big spike in voter registration this year. You know, more than 1.8 million people going to the online voter registration site to register to vote with a few clicks as opposed to filling out that paper card.
It's noticeable, too. Your office does a lot of social media.
We're trying.
Is that the reason why you're doing it?
Well, we know that as technology evolves, you know, we got to get information out in multiple platforms. We do traditional media, we do public events, we do social media, any and every way possible to get the information out to young people and
All the above strategy. Well, thanks for discussing how to increase voter turnout. Up next, you know, freedom isn't free. What do we have to do to invest to make our democracy work more efficiently and effectively? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome. We're talking with California Secretary of State Alex Padilla. You know, the cost of making elections work, it takes some money. First, we got to qualify voters. Then you got to qualify ballot measures. And then you got to come up with those detailed voter information guides. How much does all that cost?
Well, it costs, I can say, in the millions. But I think the real answer is you can't put a price tag on democracy, right? It's the bedrock of our nation, that we're a government of the people, by the people, for the people. And the way that people make their positions and their priorities heard is at the ballot box with our vote. And so, you know, you can imagine the cost involved of securing polling locations and equipment and poll workers. And
you've asked for a little more money recently from the governor of the state legislature saying, you know, to do this job, I think it was $32 million. What's the chance of that happening?
Well, the good news is the legislature and the governor approved the initial $16 million to make sure that we were ready for the primary election, with the balance of it worked into the budget process for the next fiscal year. So, you know, we budgeted initially for a bump because it's a presidential election year, more voters, more turnout. But the numbers we're seeing so far are above and beyond what we predicted. And so I'm glad the legislature and on a bipartisan basis, and the governor agreed.
Always good on a bipartisan basis. You know, back in 2000, we saw some things that could happen when things go wrong, when voting counts go awry. There appears to be a growing concern about the age of our voting machines. How old are they, and what is it going to cost to replace them?
Right. So in 2000, we saw what happened in Florida, you know, Bush v. Gore, butterfly ballots, hanging chads. And the good thing is, at a national level, we had a conversation about how not let that happen again. And so Congress acted on a bipartisan basis and provided funding for new voting systems across the country, including California. But for all the counties that bought new equipment in 2002, 2004, 2006, guess what? It's more than a decade old.
Right.
And if it's a decade old, it's built on 15 to 20-year-old technology.
And they're saying some of the like the parts, those things, those machines aren't even built anymore.
Yeah, some machines don't have replacement parts anymore. The warranties have expired, all those sorts of things. So it is time for California to invest in the next generation of voting systems. And I think coupled with, in the last segment, we talked about a new way to conduct elections that creates convenience and choice for voters. You know, we can take advantage of the opportunity to make an investment in equipment that provides that efficiency and voter choice.
Well, these machines aren't cheap, though. I was reading where I think it said that Maryland has a machine that reads paper ballots on optical scanner. Those are $5,000 a piece. And so you think about a lot of polling places, and it adds up.
I think statewide, if we replace just the kind of equipment that we have today, we're talking $450 million for the entire state. But if we're smart about how we conduct elections in a way that's actually better for voters, we can bring that price tag down.
Yeah, but it's important, right? You want to make sure the votes are counted accurately. So what about this reliable source of funding? Is there a way to kind of make funding more reliable for state offices, your office? Any ideas on how we can make that funding stream something that's more consistent?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's two pieces here. One is the equipment, which thankfully we don't have to buy each and every year. You invest in the voting systems for the state, and you can kind of count on that, at least for the good part of a decade or more. But the year-in, year-out expenses of outreach to voters, educating voters, every other year, printing sample ballots,
special elections,
and voters' information guides, those just have to be a standard part of the budget. And for the most part, it has been in California, but for a few very tough budget years where we had to get a little creative. But for the equipment piece, the capital expense, it's much more significant. Maybe we ought to establish a trust where we can feed into it each and every year so that it accumulates. You know, when there's a need for an investment in new equipment, then it's not
there.
A sticker shock for the state budget.
Right. You know, I was thinking about, you were talking about voter participation, registration. Is there a lack of civil literacy in our society? I mean, how can we get Californians to be more focused on politics and policy, particularly like in K through 12.
Right. I mean, as much as I like to think that there isn't this apathy out there, the numbers show otherwise. California ranked 43rd in the nation when it came to turnout in 2014, despite the fact that there's more than 17 million registered voters in California. We know there's another 7 million that are eligible but just haven't registered. So clearly by the numbers, we have some work to do. And I think civic education is a big piece. You know, just by observation from my travels in the state, it's wonderful when I hear young people say that, you know, they were brought up in a household where their parents talked about what was on the ballot and they took them to the polls in November so they can observe election. They were just kind of brought up with that tradition, with that value. But I know in my household, that wasn't the case. My parents are immigrants. Mm-hmm. To the United States and to California specifically, they didn't take me to go vote every November, not because they didn't want me to have that experience, but they weren't eligible at the time.
Right.
I mean, from the time they became citizens, they'd never missed an election.
Yeah, but then they became, when you were running for office, I'm thinking they signed up and they voted.
At that point, they did. But
that's good motivation.
I was well into my 20s. And so I think it just underscores the importance of, yes, we want families to pass it on from generation to generation, but we have to get in there through community organizations and especially through schools to try to make sure all young people are brought up with this information.
Well, I want to thank our guest, California Secretary of State Alex Padilla, for joining us. I also want to thank Mindy Romero, the director of the California Civic Engagement Project at UC Davis.
Up next, so how are Californians likely to vote this November? We'll get expert analysis from John Myers of the Los Angeles Times and Dan Walters from the Sacramento Bee.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
This November's ballot is a doozy. 17 ballot measures with a voter's guide that's over 200 pages long. And if that's not enough, there's the little matter of a presidential election and all the down-ticket state and local races. What does all this mean for California? We'll hear from two of the most respected observers of state politics, John Myers with the Los Angeles Times and Dan Walters with the Sacramento Bee. The 2016 election, there's a lot on the menu.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, and by Kaiser Permanente. Thrive from the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute. It's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Voters are going to be asked to decide a lot of issues in November. Fortunately, we have two of the state's best political observers to give us an insider's view on the what, why, and how of November's elections. They are Dan Walters with the Sacramento Bee and John Myers with the LA Times. Welcome.
Thank you.
Again. Dan, let me start with you. We have one statewide contest, and that's the race to replace U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer, who's been in office since 1993. The race is interesting because it's a Democrat-on-Democrat race, and that's a result of the top two primary reform of 2010, but it's not generating very much enthusiasm or interest. Why?
Well, maybe because it's kind of dull, I suppose. Kamala Harris thinks she can coast into the Senate seat, and Loretta Sanchez hasn't really been campaigning very much as yet, although in the last few days she's picked it up a little bit. But it's just kind of been a kind of a ho-hum sort of thing, not really any big clash of philosophy or personality. Well, there's a clash of personality, certainly. But it hasn't been apparent to the public. It hasn't been out there in the public realm very much.
Why no interest?
I think interest. It's been a quiet race. I mean, there's not a lot of money on the Sanchez campaign to get her message out. It's expensive in California. I mean, we all know that to run statewide campaigns. The fascinating thing about this race to me is that it's the first two same party runoff statewide since we changed the system to a top two system. Sanchez, to have a chance, has to reach out to a different group of people other than the core constituency of the Democratic Party. Those are Kamala Harris people at this point.
She's getting some Republicans.
Well, she needs Republicans. She needs independent voters. And in some of the early polling, you've seen Republicans so disinterested in the race because they don't have a candidate that they are talking about sitting it out. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a really tough thing to do. I think a lot of people have said, oh, great, we're going to have more competition in the top two system. But, you know, at the end of the day, some people still do believe in parties, and Republicans who don't trust Democrats in a lot of ways in the state may not want to vote.
I think the other thing you look at, it is a top two. It's a template. It's the first big top two statewide race, and we might have some more of them coming up in 2018. And it's kind of a template to how these things go.
You know, I think there's something where the Republicans rather aren't going to sit out, and that's the state races for state legislature. So we've got a question here of whether or not the Democrats can regain that supermajority, John. So what are your thoughts on that? Do you think they're going to gain the supermajority?
I think it's entirely possible. I mean, if you look at...
Now, they need two in the Assembly and one in the Senate, correct?
Yeah, and if you look at the math, go back 2012. 2012 was a high Democratic turnout year. It was a presidential year. Democrats got a supermajority in both houses, though it wasn't really a working supermajority in the Senate as people departed. 2014 was a low turnout year. Republicans were able to win those seats back in the Assembly. 2016, largely believed to be a pro-Democratic year, presidential race that would turn out a lot of Democrats, may turn out a lot of Republicans too. But those are hard seats to keep. But at the end of the day, what does a two-thirds majority, supermajority, get you in the legislature? I mean, you know, do Democrats really believe enough together that they would vote for taxes? Probably unlikely. Do they overturn gubernatorial vetoes? Dan knows the answer to that. They don't. So what does that effectively get you? And I think it's a headline. But after that, you still have to find these coalitions by region and by philosophy.
Good point. What do you think, Dan?
I agree with all that. I think getting a two-thirds is more symbolic than real. People talk about it, but it's more like bragging rights than it is really anything, particularly since there's a substantial block of moderate Democrats in the Assembly and may see the emergence of a similar block in the Senate. There are a couple of races going on. So, yeah, the Democrats have a good chance of getting back their two-thirds supermajority, but they didn't use it last time they had it, really. And it's unlikely they could use it if they got it this time.
It seems like those mods are well placed to have a big role in the state capitol.
Well, and also, too, look at the business groups in California. They have correctly identified that they need to play in Democratic Party right. politics. No offense to our Republican friends, but their ranks are so diminished. If you want to have an impact in the business community, you go to a certain kind of Democrat now more than you do Republican.
If you know if it's going to be a top two primary, the Democrats are both going to be 1-2. You're going to pick the one that's going to be more favorable to your pro-business
and
transition.
That's going to negate that issue of tax increases and things like that.
I want to ask about the elephant in the room.
No pun intended.
That's Donald Trump.
Is that Republican?
That's going to be a Republican reference. That's Donald Trump and the effect that he may have on turnout and maybe some of these down-ticket races. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's just such an unusual set of dynamics, it's so difficult to describe. First of all, Hillary Clinton will win California. We know that. The question is, what does it do, as you say, down-ticket races? You could argue that it's going to be a big turnout election because of all the hoopla over Trump versus Clinton. Or you could say people are so disgusted they may not turn out at all. And I don't know the answer to that question because it's, as with the top two primary or top two situation in the Senate, it's a unique situation that doesn't really gel with any past history, so you can't really tell what effect that's going to have down thing. I think the Republicans are dispirited, and it may adversely affect that. They have nothing at stake in the state, essentially, this year. There's not very little for them to turn out for. But who knows? I mean, it's really one of those kind of X-factor elections.
Well, it is an X-factor, and then you look at the level that it could have an impact, potentially, and let's look at congressional elections, right? We've got two in the Central Valley. We've got David Valadao, Republican incumbent, Jeff Denham, and Republican incumbent. Both do not want the Donald Trump label, very likely. Valadao has already said, I'm not a Trump guy. Denham has kind of said he's really said a lot about it, so stay tuned on that. But those are races that I think you could take a look at. There are probably a handful of other ones. But, yeah, at the end of the day, Hillary Clinton wins California.
Okay, well, up next, we're going to talk about all those ballot propositions on this November's ballot. Up next, crime and punishment. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with veteran political observers Dan Walters of the Sacramento Bee and John Myers of the L.A. Times about the November election. Looks like we're going to have a Proposition Palapalooza in November with 17 ballot propositions. I was reading that it was 224 pages and over a half pound.
Yep.
That's a lot of reading.
Coming to your mailbox anytime.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the more high-profile measures. We'll start with crime and punishment, Dan. Prop 64 would make recreational marijuana legal. Now, California voters rejected a similar measure in 2010, but since then, four states, Colorado, Washington, Alaska, Oregon, and the District of Columbia, have since passed measures legalizing recreational use of marijuana. Polls indicate significant support this time around.
It'll
Why is that?
Pass. changes in the electorate over time, demographic changes, attitudinal changes, similar to the changes involving gay marriage. I mean, it's something that just evolves over time, and its time has come.
I will tell you, though, what's fascinating about that measure to me is how complex it is. You know, you were talking about the voter guide on a story I wrote on that recently. Prop 64, the legal marijuana initiative, is 33 pages in that document. It's 17,000 words. And in political campaigns, if you can find the complexity and worry the voters that there's something hidden inside of a ballot measure, that's a problem. At least some of the people working on that campaign know that at the outset, people say, legalize pot, yeah, but the more they think about it and the more they hear about it, the harder the campaign comes. So I don't think Dan's wrong, but I think it's going to be interesting to
watch. Well, the other thing about it is that a lot of these, not only this measure, but other measures have a lot of ins and outs on this thing. These are not simple things. The governor's measure, which I'm sure you're going to get to, is another one. It's only a few words, but the complexity of it in applying it is incredible.
If it's complex, then the answer is just no.
Sometimes.
If there's money for an opposition campaign.
Well, actually, there's some money coming in now for the anti-Prop 34 measure. I think $1 million came in recently. Let me ask you about Prop 57. That's the governor's proposal for allowing early release of inmates convicted of specific nonviolent crimes. It follows on some earlier efforts by California in the criminal justice system dealing with realignment in 2011 and Prop 47, which reduced certain drug possessions from felonies to misdemeanors in 2014. So this is the third attempt. You've seen a little bit of a recent uptick in crime statistics. Is that going to doom the measure?
I don't think it's going to doom the measure, but it could doom the measure if the opponents, mostly the California District Attorney's Association, had the money to spend on it. That measure has a lot of holes in it, and they've been pointing out those holes. For example, it only would apply to all crimes except a handful that are specified in the penal code, and so a lot of crimes that you and I would consider violent, including several forms of rape, are considered nonviolent felonies under the governor's measure. But it's not specified in the measure itself. You have to go to the penal code and read a long section of the penal code and to find out by process of elimination what's covered and what's not covered. And the district attorney have done that, and they've pointed out all these crimes, including some that have been very sensational recently, are not considered violent crimes under the governor's measure.
You got to read that ballot measure?
Yeah,
ballot voter guide?
I have. I mean, a lot of people probably won't. I think Dan's right, and I think the other part here, too, is whether the governor, having a large megaphone that he does around the state, can convince California voters that flexibility in the punishment system is better than not flexibility. And he is a guy who pushed forward a rigid system when he was in office before. He's the guy who's got to try to make that case, and I think that's going to be
And he's selling it. He's going to editorial boards and everything. He's interesting. He got neutrality from the Sheriff's Association, neutrality from the County's Association, because they know where their money comes from, and they weren't about to challenge the governor on that issue.
I want to ask you about those two death penalty measures on the ballot, 62, which would abolish the death penalty, and 66, which would make executions easier. It's interesting that the voters seem to be split on this. Want to prognosticate.
I'll procrastinate.
Prognosticate on what's going to happen with that?
I don't know. The thing that I find interesting about those two is they're two sides of a coin, right? I mean, one of them says let's repeal the death penalty. The other one says let's speed up the death penalty. Both campaigns, I think, acknowledge fundamentally that the death penalty system in California as it exists is not working. We have an executed being one in 10 years. We have a huge population on death row. The voters have rejected death penalty repeals before. The polls show they are about to again. We have a new LA Times poll that shows that voters are against this measure at this point. They're against repealing. Expediting, I think, raises questions about legality, constitutional rights of the inmates. But at the bottom line, this is a tough sell. People sometimes, I think, make this vote based on their emotion and their gut, and they don't necessarily do it on dollars and cents.
Do you want to prognosticate or prognosticate on this?
I agree with that. The death penalty has been a tricky issue for California. If you go back in the 70s, it was on again, it was off again, it was on again, it was off again. And finally, it got on again because the legislature overturned Jerry Brown's veto back in the 1970s, right. And that's how the how we got the death penalty. But John's right. We haven't executed anybody in a decade. There's 700 and some men and women on death row. They're dying of old age, basically, rather than being executed. Mm-hmm. It's a mess. Probably neither of these measures is going to fix the mess. It's just still going to be a mess.
I guess we'll see. Well, up next, we're going to talk about some tax and spending measures on the November ballot. That conversation in a moment. This is the Mattie Report. Welcome back. We're talking about the upcoming election with John Myers of the LA Times and Dan Walters of the Sacramento Bee. So, John, let's start with Prop 55, the proposed extension of 2012's Prop 30, the temporary tax on high-income Californians. More of the don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the guy behind the tree kind of deal. There's going to be well-funded, it doesn't look like there's going to be well-funded opposition to this. So is this a done deal?
The polling shows that people like it. And I mean, let's talk about why. Because it is extending a tax on the highest income earners in California. You got to be $250,000 as a single taxpayer, higher than that for joint taxpayers. And that is more popular than the 2012 version, which had a sales tax element in it, which is now gone. But, you know, only in California can you call it an extension of a temporary tax. It was 6 years before. This is another 12. It will be 18 years if it passes that the tax is in place. I don't know if that's temporary or not.
What do you think, Dan? We'll be back in 2028 with another ballot
measure.
As you say, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the fellow behind the tree. So that makes it popular. But there is a danger to this thing. The danger is that California becomes more and more permanently dependent on how a handful of wealthy people, I mean, just really a couple of hundred thousand wealthy people in the state of 39 million, are doing in the capital markets because they get their income from capital gains. And that's called volatility. It means that when we get a recession, we catch a cold, the state gets pneumonia.
Right. Well, let me ask another one that's a similar measure, Prop 56, and that's the increase in the cigarette tax, going from 87 cents to $2 a pack. Big jump. Another one of these things where it's focusing on a small group of people. Only about 12% of Californians actually smoke now. Good idea, bad idea?
Well, it's good or bad, I can say. It's only 12% of California. We have the second lowest level of smoking in any state, second only to Utah. So it's going to affect a very small number of people. It will probably encourage a lot of them to stop smoking, I suppose, because of the cost. It is, however, a regressive tax. It hits the poor much harder than it hits affluent people. Very few affluent people smoke. Smoking is confined to the working class in California, by and large, and you're getting more money out of poor people, basically. And if that is okay with you, then it's okay.
Small number of people, and yet tens of millions of dollars in campaign spending from the tobacco industry, which is already running early in this campaign season.
And that's common. Let me ask you, John, about another measure on the expense side of the ledger. That's Prop 61 that would limit the price state agencies pay for prescription drugs to the lowest price paid by the VA. Not surprisingly, Big Pharma, talking about another industry that's getting involved, they're spending big bucks to defeat the measure. Is there a worry that this could create a national trend? Because you're hearing a lot of stuff about people upset about prescription drug prices.
I think so. I mean, yeah, huge money being spent by the pharmaceutical industry in this one. Not a huge policy issue, I think, to your point here, Mark. I mean, there's some transparency or there's some pricing issues there. There was a transparency measure in the legislature that failed that the drug industry helped kill by lobbying there. Yeah, I think they see California as the place where if it happens there, what's the fight they have nationally or in other states? And I think that's why they're making that stand.
I look forward to commercials on that. I want to ask you, Dan, about Prop 53. It's kind of interesting. It's primarily funded by this wealthy Stockton area farmer and food processor, Dan Cortopassi?
Dean Cortopassi, yes.
Sorry.
He is a wealthy farmer and businessman in Stockton
area. So what would this do? What would this measure do?
It would require a public vote for any project that's funded by revenue bonds over $2 billion. The opponents say it would affect local government. Probably not. It's really aimed at the governor's tunnels through the Delta. Dino Cortopassi hates those
He's
tunnels.
He's in Stockton.
And the assumption is that they would, if they come to pass, they would be financed with revenue bonds secured by payments from water districts. And revenue bonds can now be issued without a vote of the people, unlike general obligation
bonds. Because general obligation bonds are paid by the taxpayers, and revenue bonds are paid by the users.
Revenue. Well, there's some fuzzy stuff about that, but basically that's true. And he says, basically, why should we not be passing, be able to pass judgment on these big revenue bond issues, $2 billion or more? And he's basically financing the campaign himself, and he's got everybody against him, and he's still doing it. And it, but it's an attractive thing. It's what it says is, you, the voters, should be able to vote. And that's a, can be a very attractive thing to voters. Well, yeah, of course we should be able to vote. You shouldn't keep us from voting on something.
So is Dino Cotopassi giving the Republicans a new tactic to deal with a democratically controlled state?
I don't know, because if you look at the opposition to that, it includes the California Chamber of Commerce and a lot of business groups. I mean, the people who usually work in government think that this is a problem because it's going to mean more complexity and more fragility to a lot of these big infrastructure projects. But back to Dan's point, is exactly right. It's written in a way that says, hey, you, the voter, do you want to have more approval over spending money? Sure, check off the box.
Hard to say no to that. Well, up next, we're going to talk about this year's reform movement, some propositions on the ballot. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with Dan Walters of the Sacramento Bee and John Myers of the LA Times about this November's election. There are two measures on the November ballot that address the political process. The first relates to the transparency in the legislative process. And John, I know you've written stuff on this and done a lot of work on this. This is Prop 54, which would require bills to be in print for at least three days before they can come up for a vote by the legislature. Good idea?
I mean, it's been talked about a lot. I mean, the legislature itself has been talking about this idea for the last several years, all with the theory that too many things happen at the 11th hour. Too many legislative deals, things are crammed into bills, shoved up for a vote before anybody has a chance to look at it, the lawmakers or the public, and this is a reaction to that. I think the devil's in the details. The challenge is like, how is it going to work on a basis when something important comes up? That's at least the opposition's mantra so far in this race. And then there's another element to Prop 54, which talks about using the video footage from legislative debates, and you'd be able to use them in campaigns, which the opponents think is a way in to, you know, exacerbating the politicization of the policy process. I'm not saying it's not politicized already. This has been talked about a long time. I think at the end of the day, voters go, I don't like the legislature. I think that they don't do a good job. Maybe this is a vote against them in that way by voting for.
What about the unintended consequences of this? I mean, negotiations, you need to do that sometimes in backroom deals where you can let your hair down and be honest. If everything is out in the public,
it doesn't say you
a little
can't
more
do
difficult.
Backroom deal. It just says you have to put the bill in print for 30
The backroom deal has to start earlier.
Just before coming into this taping, I was actually looking at a bill that was drafted and passed in a few hours on the last day of the legislative session. It's got some stuff in there that is potentially very far-reaching, and it's a lousy way to make policy, to have this stuff come up at the last minute. It's called lowballing, and the lowball artists, the people who wait till that last minute so they can get their stuff through and without any scrutiny, it's gotten to be epidemic status, and something needs to be done.
Now, you're really talking about gutting amend, John, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and so, but wasn't gutting amend, I was looking, doing some research, and found that 2014's Prop 1 water bond was the product of a gut and amend procedure. I guess the original assembly bill was talking about something about fireworks.
Yeah.
And that
got changed
rather radically.
And they've been talking about water for a while. So in some ways, that one had been floating around, pun intended, around the Capitol for a bit. But there are these interest group 11th hour deals that do happen. I mean, you know, we've had years past, we had like public employee contract proposals in the 11th hour. We've had tax breaks in the 11th hour. We had energy deregulation in the waning days. I mean, there are a lot of...
The LA Stadium, I believe.
Yeah, there are a lot of bad actors, or poster children, you could say, you know, for why Prop 54 needs to be in place. I think the real question is, does it work the way that the advocates say they want it to work in terms of creating more transparency? And I think that's, you know, hard to determine.
Yeah, there are exceptions in that measure for emergency situations, too, one should note.
Okay. I guess you have to read that voter guide, that 200-and-some-page voter guide.
Light reading.
Well, Dan, let me ask you about this. There's a Prop 59, which is an advisory measure that's on the ballot, and it asks whether California officials should use all of their constitutional authority, including proposing one or more amendments to the U.S. Constitution to overturn the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United. Is this just Don Quixote tilting at windmills?
Well, it probably is Don Quixote, but it also opens the door to putting a whole bunch of advisory measures on the ballot and really cluttering up the budget, even the ballot even more, with more non-binding, symbolic, feel-good ballot measures, which I think is pretty dangerous. Now, on this specific issue, it's kind of disingenuous and hypocritical, and frankly, for the legislature to rail against Citizens United when all Citizens United did is to legalize the campaign finance system that those very same legislators use in California.
Independent expenditures.
Independent expenditure. And so they're railing against it, but they are certainly not averse to using it themselves and continue to use it themselves. And if they really wanted to do something about it, they would change the California finance system, which they're not willing to do.
Yeah. Let me ask you one last question, both of you. John, we start with you. Yep. So we have 17 measures on the November ballot. Is this a robust exercise in direct democracy, or is it just showing representative democracy maybe is broken?
I don't know. The polling consistently shows that voters want to tinker with the initiative process and the direct democracy system, but they like it. They want to continue to have those options. You look at this list of ballot measures. It could have been longer. For instance, minimum wage was going to be on the ballot had it not a deal been struck in the state capitol. But at the end of the day, you have people who don't go to the legislature. And this is not all people who didn't get their say in the legislature. There's some actors here who just went directly to the ballot. And I think there's big money and there are big decisions.
10 seconds. What do you think?
I think that by concentrating all these ballot measures in November and not allowing on the June ballot, we've set the stage to have these kind of huge ballots for years and years to come, and we're all going to get sick and tired of it eventually.
Okay, with that goodness, I want to thank Dan Walters of the Sacramento Bee and John Myers of the LA Times. If you want to stay up with state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or by logging on to our website at maddieinstitute.org. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.